lectionary would have us wrestle with one of the most enigmatic stories told in the Synoptic Gospels. We suspend our series on the questions you have been asking and begin a series on the questions Jesus asks. Who do you say that I am? Why are you afraid? Why do you doubt? And if you greet your brethren only, what is unusual about that? Do not unbelievers do the same? What do you want me to do for you? Why do you call me good? Do you not yet understand? My God, why have you forsaken me? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Woman, whom do you seek? Do you love me more than these? The question of the morning is a question Jesus asks the disciples just before he takes Peter and John and James up with him to the mountaintop to pray. Who do you say that I am? Biblical scholars only speculate about what led Peter to say Jesus is the Messiah of God. You can go back through the Gospel of Luke and point to this miracle or that saying of Jesus, but even the accumulation of these moments cannot account for the leap. That Jesus was praying alone with his disciples, only his disciples near him, before he asked this question, has led some to wonder if the conversation Jesus was having with God became, for those closest to him, a revelation of the relationship between what we used to say God and man. God and man. Not a human being doesn't quite get it. God and human. A relationship that was unlike any before or since. Peter's confession literally translated, "You are the anointed one," as was David. You are the anointed one. You are the one who has been chosen by God. And if Peter understood the plot correctly, you are the one who has come to redeem God's people, Israel. Now, Peter knew nothing of the 4th century Christological controversies concerning the second person of the Trinity, or the debate about the two natures of Christ, or John's prologue presuming the preexistence of the Word. He knew the Hebrew Scriptures. And so the promises made by God to God's people. Perhaps Peter said Jesus was the Messiah of God, because as one who read his own life through the lens of that story, here was a teacher who was more than the word prophet could contain. Jesus, meaning God has saved, was the long-awaited answer to Peter's prayers and the prayers of God's people. Here was the servant of God who had come to unite God's people once again and keep them safe in the land God had promised them. It is the prayer God's chosen people pray to this day. How jarring it must have been for them when the next words out of Jesus' mouth were words about his suffering and rejection and death, his killing and rising. Who do you say that I am? It was as though Jesus needed to make sure immediately that Peter knew what he was saying when he said, "You are the Messiah of God." Suffering, rejection, death, rising. No doubt Jesus' words sent Peter back to search the Scriptures and possess. For the sake of the life you will be given by God. This was no supposition on Luke's part. It had become the facts of life for those who did follow him, for those who became players in the ongoing plot of God's dealings with the world that Luke records in his second act called Acts. Add 2,000 years to that plot, and you come to us in the year of our Lord, 2013. And to the question Jesus asks you and me, thanks to Luke, as directly as he asked the 12, who do you say that I am? On one hand, a hand I often play, you could say that we have been given the answer by the church's creeds and confessions and doctrines. Of those who have been set apart by the community to wrestle with the name until the break of day, there are scholars more learned than we are and readers of the Bible more careful than we are who have told us in great detail about the identity of Jesus. It is, in fact, my responsibility to represent the response of Christ's church through the ages to Jesus' question in this community most Sundays. A response that partakes of complexity and controversy, of schism and endless volumes of systematic theology. Good old who? Karl Barth. I'm not quoting him this Sunday, though. And I'm not quoting him this Sunday because I also believe each one of us stands singly before him and must answer the question one way or another, with our lives. With our lives. Like Peter, we have the scriptures. And we have the church's theological tradition. But we also have a living Lord who continues to surprise us because he is alive. Even though we continue to prefer him under the wraps of human reason. Who do you say that I am? A prophet? A philosopher? A social activist? A spiritual guide? These are who the crowds say that he is, and I would say a good number of us in his church say about the same thing. It's about as much as we can say without having to change what we do or decide or trust or know to say that we follow the Christian religion. To these confessions, Jesus says there are two ways of doing human life. Letting it go in order to find it, or hanging on. The second, says Robert Johnson, is the geriatric pattern. How does it happen? How does it happen in this poor world that any of us ever leap to leave behind the possible and wrestle until break of day with the mystery whose name we do not know? For some, it may happen in a burst of light, on a road to Damascus or Emmaus or at the Jabbok. But for most of us here, knowing him and following him begins at the font. As little Morgan Elizabeth Evans has been born anew by water and the Spirit into this family of faith, she has been born into a community whose church school teachers and ministers will join her parents and her grandparents as together we tell her the old, old story. We do this because how else in the world will she know that God is with her and for her and has called her by name. Lillian Daniels writes of a family whose children had only a year of church school under their belts. In the middle of what was his second Christmas pageant rehearsal ever, their little boy cried out in total exasperation, "Do you mean to tell me that we are doing the exact same story we did last year?" Consciously heard that story as a child, I am still telling myself the same story. We are telling each other the same story because the one who is dead is alive and keeps sending us back the story to learn again, like Peter, to read our lives through him. In fact, we who mostly resemble Simeon and Anna now are reading the Bible together every Wednesday morning, and we have been doing this for how many years? I'd say a dozen minimally, right? And we get older and older and older together. But we're not geriatric about it, I don't think. So, because I believe reading the Bible together will change your life, will be an occasion for you to wrestle till break of day for the name. I know this is crazy because of the lives you lead, you who are not quite as geriatric as I am. Crazy to think that you could take a night to do this with children's homework and late hours at the office and so little time to catch your breath. But for the season of Lent, spur of the moment, I would love to spend my Monday nights, because I'm not doing anything. I'd like to spend my Monday nights with you, wrestling with the meaning of the same story together, in the wild hope that we each might wrestle with the mystery until he calls our name at the break of day outside an empty tomb. Or what if, over the next 6 weeks, you set out to take one small step toward him, literally? Think of this as practice for losing your life. Sleep with the homeless. Feed hungry men at our brother's place. Stand vigil at Delia's gun shop. Learn about human trafficking and begin working to end it. Sometimes follow me means leaving where you are and going where you would never go because he has gone before you. The call to follow, says Dietrich Bonhoeffer, at once produces a new situation. The first step places the disciple in a situation where faith is possible. Possible because all the other stories and institutions and ideologies and possessions we put our trust in are left behind as objects of trust. Our relationship to them is changed because to live or to practice living as though he were our only trust in life and in death is what it is to follow him. But, says Bonhoeffer, this step is not the first stage of a career. Its sole justification is that it brings the disciple into fellowship with Jesus. Then again, if Bible study at night or social witness is too big a leap to comprehend this Lent for you, sometimes that first step might be as ordinary as leaving your home every single Sunday morning. Every single Sunday morning. Every single Sunday morning. And coming to worship. Or you will sing the story and hear the story over and over again. And if not quite make diligent use of the means of grace, then at least participate while you are here in the sacraments and the community of faith. this will take you, and with whom? Who knows if, in the presence of a complete stranger, your whole life might turn on a dime? Maybe the same thing could happen on the couch watching Meet the Press, or walking in the woods after new-fallen snow. Maybe. But the story the church keeps telling again and again suggests that a more likely encounter with the living Lord may be given as you place yourself face to face with another whose life makes a claim on your life, on your will defended and very limited and terribly valuable time. Or to put this point another way, and as Daniels has said, to know a little bit of criticism. Any idiot can see God in a sunset. Think about it. What is remarkable is finding God in the context of flawed human community, with people who may not reflect God back to you in your own image. Who do you say that I am? How does it happen that any one of us ever leaps to leave the possible behind and wrestle until the break of day to be given the name above every name? Who do you say that I am? If you cannot quite bring yourself to say what Peter says, or Luke, or the early church fathers, or the creeds, and try saying this one word with your life. Say love. Say love. Because at the end of the day, or at the break of dawn, it is love we confess when we say, I believe in Jesus Christ, God's only Son, our Lord. Says Robert Jensen, is neither a sentiment nor a feeling, but a shorthand for a narrative, death and resurrection. Death and resurrection is what love